This is Addiction Medicine Journal Club. I'm Dr. Sonia Daltredici.
And I'm Dr. John Keenan.
We believe that addiction is a disease that can be treated, and we want to help you stay up to date with the latest research that you can use in your addiction medicine practice. Also, remember, you can get Category 1 CME credit through MyCares and Michigan State University. The links for the CME will be in the show notes. This week, we are going to discuss an article about whether cognitive performance improves with alcohol abstinence. So how are you doing tonight, John?
I'm doing great. I'm always enjoying this fall spring that we get here in the early part of the spring in South Central PA. 70 degrees one day, 30 the next.
Yeah, it was 27 degrees this morning as I drove into work, which was a little sad. But it's okay. Kills off all the ticks. Less Lyme disease this summer. That's what I keep thinking.
But will that be less chronic Lyme's is the question. I don't know.
No, it will not. So, John, what have you been thinking about in addiction medicine news this week?
I saw this really great article from St. Louis Public Radio. And I love how EMS has really been like an expanded in terms of its use for many different reasons. I've seen some articles recently about in some areas that actually for sepsis, that EMS can provide, like obtain blood cultures and provide first dose of antibiotics en route to hospitals in some settings. And this is something similar, kind of expanding their role into addiction medicine. So in Missouri, there's actually six EMS districts that have received a grant where they're actually allowed to now administer buprenorphine in the field. And so basically, the setting is that someone with kind of a naloxone save or a reversal, oftentimes anyone that's done that knows that those patients often wake up very unhappy, they're in withdrawal, they can throw up on you, they can be very combative or upset because they feel awful, right? And so the thought is that they're reviving them in the field. Could they follow that with a dose of buprenorphine to combat the withdrawal type symptoms and to also stabilize them either for transport to the hospital for further treatment, or actually they were linking them to outpatient care if they were not going to go to the hospital for care. And so I thought that was really cool. I just love like kind of incorporating other aspects of the healthcare field to kind of engage in treatment here. I think that if we kind of just rely on like the docs and the APPs, we're just not going to make headway as much as we can. We got to meet people where they're at.
That's so true. And yeah, shout out to all the EMTs and paramedics out there. Do you ever use the community paramedic service in York?
Yeah, I do.
Yeah, me too. Yeah, they've really expanded the scope of what they're willing and able to do for patients, which is really cool. That's such a great idea. I wonder, do they have any data on like outcomes? Have they tried this a bunch of times or are they just getting it started?
They're just launching it. And they basically have a grant to pilot it in these six counties or six regions, the EMS regions. And you know what I thought was interesting? That actually they kind of report that the number one reason they're actually proceeding with the pilot is a form of basically combating their caregiver burnout. So the EMS have kind of basically in this area stated that they have a lot of kind of burnout responding to kind of repeated overdoses. A little bit of compassion fatigue. And instead of kind of just complaining about it or having like a decompression, they're like, why don't we do something about it to help these people? So I think that's a really positive way to kind of use some of that data regarding caregiver burnout to not only help the providers, but also help our patients.
That's really great. It's such a great idea. It makes me think we should try something similar in our area. It seems like complicated, but maybe not so complicated to implement.
I don't know. Is it that complicated? Especially kind of post-naloxone, I feel like that's a great patient to administer to, right?
Yes and no. The question of, is it really that complicated? That's one you don't want to ask, you know?
All right. Fair enough.
Well, I had something I wanted to share with our listeners and with you. One of our listeners sent in an article he wrote, and I was interested in your take on it. So it's by Dr. Casey Grover, and he's a fellow addiction medicine podcaster. He hosts a podcast called Addiction Medicine Made Easy, which is really awesome if anybody wants to check it out. And his article is about post-acute withdrawal syndrome, which is basically when patients have symptoms of opioid or any other drug withdrawal that occur weeks or months after the patient has stopped the drug. So it's not the acute withdrawal syndrome over the first few days, and it's not the sort of long but low-key withdrawal syndrome you can feel, you know, in the first 6 months after you stop opioids or benzodiazepines or alcohol. It's more sort of acute withdrawal, but separate in time from your kind of use of drugs and when you stop them. So is this something you ever see, John? Patients have real withdrawal symptoms, but not right when they stop drugs, but weeks later?
Yeah, I do see this guy not infrequently. And I don't kind of understand quite the mechanism or what's going on or whether it's psychosocial kind of new habits, new behaviors, or they sensitize it to their body and like re-experiencing sensations that they didn't have before because of the drugs? Is it rewiring? I'm not quite sure. I know they keep renaming it. I think post-acute withdrawal is the most recent. I think it used to be called protracted abstinence syndrome. You know, it's a very real phenomenon. I'd be interested to know like the pathophysiology behind it. Did you get into that at all during it?
No. And I even tried to look it up myself to say, I realized I don't actually really understand opioid withdrawal that well, you know, then which I understand it kind of in broad strokes, but I wasn't even sure what really is going on with prolonged opioid withdrawal. And it turns out I'm not alone. It's really not completely understood. And people keep publishing articles about new facets of opioid withdrawal that they're discovering. But basically, it's very complex, involves multiple areas of the brain, multiple neurotransmitters. And so when this happens to people, I don't know, is it just some sort of acute neurotransmitter episode that is the same as when you're having opioid withdrawal? My patients often feel it when they're triggered by a situation. You know, they'll go by a place they used to use drugs and suddenly they're feeling acute withdrawal. Although that might just be coincidence, or that might be when people really note it. But I've definitely had people experience withdrawal symptoms kind of separate from the drug use, you know, as I said, weeks or even months later.
I mean, it's a very real thing. I think there is a neurobiochemical mediation there, right? Especially when you talk about people going by places. I have to pull up the study, but I have seen, like when I was studying for the boards, like fMRI studies about people seeing locations where they used to get drugs from and parts of the lower brain kind of lighting up on fMRI. I very much believe it's real and patients experience it. And I think it's more than just kind of like a psychosocial issue. I think it really is kind of a neurobiochemical mechanism.
I think what's hard is it's also just kind of nonspecific. You know, any symptom of opiate withdrawal could be from something else, be it nausea, shaking, hot flashes, insomnia, depression. You know, you could blame it on any number of other things. So I think it's also sometimes not recognized. So then the big question is, what do you do about it? You know, and there's no data, at least there's no data on this in this review article he wrote about ideal management. I mean, for me, I probably would just use buprenorphine if you're having symptoms of opioid withdrawal.
Yeah, basically. That's what I do, right? You know, pros and cons of dose escalation, develop a recovery plan, relapse prevention plan, you know, try to hit it from multiple areas.
Yeah, and treat the symptoms. If there's a predominant symptom like nausea, you know, that can be treated separately. Yeah, it's very interesting. And I also want to thank Dr. Casey. If anybody else wants to send us articles you wrote or articles that you read that you think we might like, please do. Especially if it's an article that's really made an impact on you or changed your practice. We'd love to hear about it. John, are you ready to tell everybody about your article?
Yeah, I'm kind of excited about this article, more so like personally, like blast from the past. As an undergraduate, I did research in basically neuropsychology. So this is kind of right up my area of not expertise, but certainly a lot of time I spent kind of collecting some of these data markers. It's called Effects of Abstinence from Opioids on Neuropsychological Performance in Men with Opioid Use Disorder. And it's a longitudinal study. It's from the Journal of Addiction Medicine, September, October, 2023. So a little bit of background. Opioids are one of the oldest psychoactive substances known to man, with use in the dependent pattern affecting 1.2% of the global population. Prevalence of non-medical opioid use is highest in Southeast Asia, followed by North America. I think that's something that often most of us kind of in addiction medicine in the United States forget, that really, while the problem's bad here, there's other places in the world that it's much worse. Impairment of neuropsychological functioning among persons with long-term opioid use in a harmful or dependent manner has been well established and has been reported in up to 39% of users, and that's chronic users. Some studies have employed neuroimaging to demonstrate atrophy of the left temporal region in the brain linked to verbal learning and memory deficits among patients with opioid use disorder. Interestingly, neuroimaging findings were consistent among patients with opioid use disorder regardless of whether they're receiving opioids illicitly or if they were in a medication for opioid use disorder treatment program, so our kind of buprenorphine and methadone patients as well. The permanence of neuropsychological dysfunction is highly debatable, with some studies showing improvements in impairment with abstinence to that of healthy controls and other studies suggesting persistent effects. A meta-analysis from 2016 concluded that gray matter changes in the bilateral frontotemporal regions have a negative association with duration of opioid use and positive association with abstinence, a finding suggesting that neuropsychological performance with abstinence is likely to be correlated with structural changes in the brain in areas known to be responsible for what we think of as cognitive function. Almost all available studies to date regarding neuropsychological functioning among patients with opioid use disorder are cross-sectional or case reports in nature, and they're basically just comparing patients at different time intervals, but no real good long prospective study on the topic to date. Is this something you see often, Sonia, in your patients or patients talk to you about, whether they use that term or not?
Yes and no. Actually, it's super interesting. I had a resident with me at clinic today, so we saw a whole set of patients all on buprenorphine, relatively stable. And the resident commented afterwards, everybody seemed really kind of tired and spacey in the whole clinic. And she, you know, this is a resident who doesn't have a lot of experience with buprenorphine, especially not seeing a bunch of patients all together. And that was her impression, that everybody just seemed kind of tired, flat, not real bubbly or energetic or sharp. And I've had patients, not so much that they complain about it when they're on buprenorphine, because usually they're coming onto buprenorphine from something a lot worse, like illicit opioids. So they feel so much better that they have a hard time recognizing negative side effects from buprenorphine. But then when they taper off and are completely opioid free, or patients who've been on other opioids that they've tapered off, I do have people say their brain is just a lot clearer. They're thinking clearer, they're noticing things more, they're more awake, they're more engaged. And they did feel that the opiates were really causing not so much cognitive dysfunction, but like a slowing or a sedation.
Yeah, definitely. I think this topic comes up not infrequently to varying degrees for patients. I think it's tough. And this study will get into it, but at least for a lot of the patients I see, they're also on psychotropics and often heavy psychotropics. So like, it's tough to kind of tease that out, like what is actually the slowing there. So the clinical question here was, what is the neuropsychological function in patients with opioid use disorder? And what is the effect of absence over an 8-week period of time on neuropsychological functioning? So this study, it was a prospective observational study of 50 male patients aged 18 to 55, evaluating the effects of opioid absence on neurological functioning. So unlike many of our previous articles that we cover in Journal Club here, this is basically non-medications for opioid use, so absence or naltrexone. The study population was males 18 to 55. They met the DSM criteria for opioid use disorder. They excluded a lot of different patients, which actually I think is kind of nice to tease out the actual effects of the opioids. So any comorbid substance except for nicotine or caffeine was excluded. Any active major mental illness, so anyone with bipolar, schizophrenia, dementia was excluded. Subnormal intelligence, so low IQ was excluded. Less than 6 years of formal education, so lack of education was excluded. Patients with neurodegenerative disease, history of stroke, history of concussions or serious head injury, patients with seizure disorder, Parkinsonism, HIV, active suicidal ideation, or patients in active intoxication or withdrawal, they were all kind of basically excluded from analysis here. Recruitment came from outpatient community clinics and emergency departments of a tertiary level, multi-specialty, public-funded hospital in northern India. And what they assessed was they had a semi-structured interview for sociodemographic and clinical profiles. They did a CAL score and a SOS score, so a clinical and subjective opioid withdrawal score. They did a stages of change in readiness and treatment eagerness, a Socrates 8D, a severity of opioid dependence questionnaire, an opioids craving scale, and then the neuropsychological functioning testing was the Wisconsin card sort testing for executive functioning, the digit span forward and backwards for attention and concentration, the recognition test for nonverbal memory, verbal retention for similar pairs and dissimilar pairs for verbal memory. So those were four very validated neuropsychological tests. So the study protocol was that you were enrolled and they obtained basically sociodemographic and a clinical profile and a baseline UDS. If needed, they would detoxify you. So they use things like clonidine, zolpidem, diclofenac, oral rehydration solution, and they would convert you to oral naltrexone if you felt the need to do so. And most patients did actually feel the need to be converted to oral naltrexone. At baseline, which is week zero of absence, they did a severity of opioid dependence questionnaire, CALS, SOS, stages of change and readiness, and then they did the complete neuropsych panel that we talked about before. They did a follow-up at 2 weeks of absence, repeating the CALS, stages of change and readiness, and the neuropsych testing. And they did a follow-up at week 8 where they did the same tests, including the neuropsych profiles with a repeat UDS, kind of confirming continued abstinence. they did descriptive statistics of continuous variables and percentage of categorical variables with ANOVA to kind of do analysis of kind of what was statistically significant amongst these. Any questions about the trial or thoughts there?
I'm not sure if you said this or not. All the patients met criteria for opioid use disorder. Were a lot of them using like buprenorphine or methadone, or were they all using illicit opioids?
This was illicit opioids. I don't talk about that in the results, but most were actually heroin users.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So is this trial valid? So kind of a couple things. There was no conflicts of interest reported by the authors. It was a prospective longitudinal study. So this is kind of nice for addiction medicine once again. Moderate sample size of 50 patients. Although to be quite frank, with those exclusion criteria, I think that'd be very difficult to get a large group. I'm surprised they got 50 that could hit all of those buckets for exclusion, especially kind of mental illness and any kind of low education level, any history of trauma. I mean, that's a lot of stuff that was exclusionary here. It was exclusively young male population, so this didn't look to female, so it may limit generalizability because of that. Interestingly, they were predominantly using semi-synthetic opioids, so heroin was used by 72% of the participants, so that was kind of the drug of choice. You know, that may kind of limit extrapolation to patients that I treat, which are mostly fentanyl users at this point. The 8-week duration was relatively short. I actually thought this might bias the study in a direction against their favor. I think that might not be enough time to really see a true treatment effect. One that I think was valid is there's no control group. I'd like to see just like a baseline group of patients without opioid use disorder to see how they did it with repeat testing. You know, there is a learning to these tests. So, you know, is some of the improvement just related to someone repeating a test 3 times?
Right. Either people without opioid use disorder or people with opioid use disorder who didn't stop using drugs.
Yeah. Co-founding bias was minimized. Like I said, they excluded the other substances as well. I think that sometimes that also comes into play. Like, could this be related to kind of previous like stimulant use, meth use, benzodiazepine withdrawal, heavy alcohol use? Those all can affect neuropsych function and cognitive function as well. And like I talked about, those neuropsych tests that they use, they're relatively easy to administer, and they're very well validated with a long track record. So this isn't something they kind of made up. So we know these tests are valid markers for neuropsych parameters and testing. Any thoughts there?
No, I mean, I think it was a valid trial. I think, like you said, the big problem is a lack of control group, but I appreciate their attempts to really isolate the opioids as like a single factor that might affect cognitive function. And I also, they're young people, so it's like they have no other reason to have cognitive dysfunction.
So the results here, a little bit about the study population. 50 out of 60 patients screened were included in the study. The most common reason for exclusion was inability to maintain follow-up or abstinence. The mean age was 28. The mean duration of opioid use was 4 years. Most were high school educated or less. That was 82%. Most were unemployed or unskilled workers, so 30 and 36% respectively. Most were unmarried at 66%. Most used semi-synthetic opioids. Heroin was the one that was most used at 72%. Most were IV drug users at 52%. And 78% did utilize the oral naltrexone conversion. So they didn't kind of just cold turkey it and muscle through it. So there still was some kind of medication assistance here.
I don't really know the situation in India, but you know, like you said in your introduction, Southeast Asia has the highest rates of opioid use disorder in the world, or opiate use in the world. And we're seeing more and more research coming out of Southeast Asia, but all the papers we've profiled have had abstinence as a treatment. We haven't seen a lot of people on buprenorphine or methadone. And I wonder if that's just cultural. Also, the papers we've looked at have all been only men, which seems like another cultural difference.
It'd be great information actually to know. Should probably look that up later on.
We should do a addiction medicine journal club field work. Should
I? Probably should have looked it up before I presented this, but yeah.
That's all right. If any of our listeners know the answer to these questions or you do treat addiction in India, we would love to hear what it's like there.
Yeah. So kind of the stuff that everyone cares about, like how do people perform on these neuropsych profiles? So interestingly, there were improvements in all domains with abstinence. And when you look at it, attention and concentration from the digit span forward and backwards, verbal memory from the verbal retention for similar and dissimilar pairs, and nonverbal memory for the verbal recognition test, they actually had very abrupt, statistically significant improvements from week 0 to week 2. So it was very quick for those to have a statistically significant improvement in performance. And when you look at, like, for example, digit forward was 6.1 baseline to 6.88. That was a statistically significant of a P of less than 0.001. Digit backwards, 3.46 to 3.86. So they were like moderate statistically significant improvements, each of these. On the flip side, executive function, which is probably the one that I think most patients probably care about, I would imagine the most, that did improve as well. And that was the Wisconsin card sort test, although that improvement was delayed. So really, it didn't hit statistical significance from the week 2 to week 8 profile. And that was basically in all parts of the Wisconsin card sort subtypes, except for non-perseverative errors. So once again, kind of statistically significant improvements in executive function week 2 to week 8, not the first 2 weeks. Subgroup analysis showed no statistically significant neuropsychological performance differences between patients abstaining from opioids with or without the use of naltrexone. So naltrexone did not modify how much of an improvement patients had with this. They also looked at like some baseline neuropsych results kind of relative to opioid use and also frequency of daily opioid use. So what they looked at was severity of opioid dependence had a statistically significant positive correlation with duration of opioid use, and that was statistically significant. Baseline verbal memory has a statistically significant negative correlation with total duration of opioid use, but no other neuropsych parameters had any kind of statistically significant correlation with duration of opioid use at baseline. So just the baseline verbal memory and the duration of use. In terms of baseline neuropsych results relative to frequency of daily opioid intake, performance on nonverbal testing had significant differences in baseline assessment scores between the groups in terms of frequency of use. Performance on executive functioning, specifically a subgroup of the Wisconsin card sort test, did have significantly difference in baseline assessment scores between groups based upon frequency. So executive function did kind of have some modification with frequency. But no other baseline neuropsych testing had any change based upon how frequently someone was using opioids. What did you think of those results?
Not super surprised, although I really did like the concept that these sort of neuropsych results that are kind of the memory and attention and concentration tests, they improved right away. And then the executive function tests improved more after 2 weeks of abstinence. So it allows you to give patients a little bit of information about what to expect as they come off opioids and, you know, pass through a few weeks of abstinence. I didn't know what to expect, but I don't think I expected that there would be that difference in the two different types of neuropsych testing. Did the results surprise you?
I kind of wish that they had a little bit a longer time period to follow to see if there was still more improvement to expect. Because I think that this doesn't really affect how I treat patients, but it does kind of treat how I counsel them about like what to expect going forward with their recovery. I mean, I was surprised that actually all those domains improved that quickly. I feel like 8 weeks is a relatively short period of time, in my opinion.
Well, and some of the other stuff we've looked at, you know, in terms of brain recovery after stopping use of illicit drugs, the time frame's more like 6 months or even 12 months.
Or never.
Right. For some people, never.
I mean, there is stuff, right? There is some irreversible changes as well that they've shown. So I don't know. I think that's incredibly optimistic, right? That's kind of cool to tell people that they're going to have improvement in how their brain functions in as little as 2 weeks.
What we don't have, which of course is impossible to get, but would be amazing, would be baseline cognitive function prior to starting using opioids.
Yeah, that would be interesting, but pretty much impossible to get. So the question is, like, does this really help me in patient care, this particular article? You know, to be honest, this doesn't affect what I'm going to do with the individual patient, right? My treatment plan is still going to be to tailor a treatment plan to the patient that works best for them. I have very few patients that choose naltrexone for opioid use disorder. I have a couple. I will be honest with you, I have no one on oral naltrexone right now for opioid use disorder. The few I do have are on the IM formulation. However, patients that come for treatment, especially at their baseline, they're kind of down, depressed. They feel like they've really damaged their body and their brain, right? I hear this all the time, kind of, I'm not sure if it's a self-fulfilling prophecy at some point, but they think that they've done irreversible harm to their brain, their health, and to their lives. And I think they feel like almost like defeatists a little bit. So I think giving them this kind of counseling that they will have at least cognitive improvement, I mean, they'll know that their life will improve too, and I can get their health back on track. I do all of that at my visits as well. Whatever kind of opioid-related complications they have, I manage and treat too. Just one more thing to kind of build them up and kind of keep them motivated into their treatment. So not practice changing, but I think I can use it to help people.
The problem is that the people in this study were opioid abstinent. And like you said, I don't have anybody on naltrexone for opioid use disorder right now. I have some people taking it for alcohol use disorder, and maybe there could be some crossover, but the opioid use disorder, everybody in my clinic is on buprenorphine. Not that that's the only solution I recommend. Like, if someone wants to be abstinent, that's fine. But if they're abstinent, they don't see me. Like, they don't really need to see the doctor to tell me that they're not using opioids every 2 weeks. So I'm not totally sure I can apply it to the majority of my patients with opioid use disorder.
I don't know. I have a couple. And not only that, I mean, I just people all the time that want to taper off, right? So, you know, they do talk about that the medications for opioid use, the agonists, are also associated with some of these cognitive declines. While this study didn't look specifically at that, it would suggest that if they are stable and they want to taper off, they might find further improvements from a cognition standpoint. Not that that's a reason to taper or discontinue treatment.
Yeah, but I think it could. And I actually would probably use this paper even more with patients who are on legal opioids. I have a little tiny sub practice helping people taper off high dose prescribed opioids. And that's one of the benefits I could kind of tell people. You might feel your mind is a lot clearer. Your cognitive function will improve. So I actually think maybe I'll use this result in that population.
I find that's a harder group sometimes, just anecdotally. I think the students and the residents might come to like my clinic with my patients, my MAT clinic or MOUD clinic, I guess we're calling it now. I think they're always surprised at how pleasant the experience is. And I think a lot of it is because like that group has a lot of insight into that substances are a problem. I think sometimes that's the difficulty with some patients on chronic opioids is that they haven't yet hit that point where they feel that there's an issue.
Well, right. I mean, I rarely work with anybody who doesn't want to taper, but I've had quite a few patients who say, you know what, these opioids that I'm taking that you guys have been prescribing have gotten out of hand. I don't feel better. I feel worse. It's kind of ruining my life. I want off. You know, so I have a few patients like that. Well, John, thank you for presenting that article. I did want to share a comment from one of our listeners. This is from Dr. Jane Liebschutz, and she wrote us a email about the article we did in episode 37, which was about sublingual versus injectable buprenorphine. That was one that John did. It was a very good episode. So she said, really enjoyed taking apart this complex article. Want to make a comment on Sonia's commenting about the number of assessments, suggesting correctly that there will be at least something that shows a difference if you do enough assessments. Now, if you guys remember, I'm no longer quoting, this was an article that did a ton of different psychological assessments. And we had a little bit of back and forth about how many was too many for a single clinical trial. So Dr. Liebschutz continues, in properly run clinical trials, the primary and secondary outcomes are predetermined and other assessments are intended to help explain the primary and secondary outcomes. High quality journals will only publish findings that are consistent with the predetermined outcomes. So even if a minor assessment shows a difference, but the primary outcomes are not different, the trial will still be considered a null trial. As someone who runs substance use clinical trials, we always try to balance the scientific findings with the respondent burden. Most participants can fairly easily do many of the assessments and get compensated for their time. I also really enjoyed hearing about the tidbits you offer at the beginning. Fentanyl teratogenicity, genetic testing for opioid exposure. So keep up the good work. So thank you for being a listener, Dr. Liebschutz, and thank you for that very insightful comment about episode 37.
I think she's like number two fan after your mom.
Yeah, moms are always the number one fan. Sorry, no one can bump moms out of that spot. Well, thank you everyone for listening to the Addiction Medicine Journal Club. The best part of any journal club is the conversation, and we want to hear what you have to say. To have your opinions about the articles included in a future episode, please send us your comments on all the social medias. We'll put the links in the show notes. Our original theme music was composed and performed by Benjamin Kennedy, audio editing by Aaron McHugh, CME support from MyCares, produced by Dr. Patrick Beeman and Ars Longa Media. Addiction Medicine Journal Club is intended for educational purposes only and should not be considered medical advice. The views expressed here are our own and do not necessarily reflect those of our employers or the authors of the articles we review. All patient information has been modified to protect their identities. So thank you for being part of the conversation and have a great day.